Okay, this is the oral history, the National Council of Jewish Women. Today is the 5th of June, 1991. I'm Mary Harrison, the interviewer, with Gabby Dinman taking notes, and we're interviewing David Krantz, and this is tape two, side one. So we're interviewing on the second floor of Anathan House. David, you mentioned a nurse.
Yes.
Eventually became a physician.
Who had been at my delivery in 1924, and at that time she was a nurse, and later went on to medical school and became an obstetrician gynecologist, and her name is Dr. Florence Marcus.
She's now 92 years old.
Is that what she is?
Yes. Do you have anything that you can tell us about Dr. Marcus that you've learned, you know, that you know about her?
The only thing that I know is one activity that I've been involved in is called the National Achievement Clubs, which is an integrated organization, and they celebrate George Washington Carver Week every January. She has been a loyal member of that organization for more years than I have, and I think I've been associated for since probably the late 60s, so it's, you know, 20 plus years for me. For her, it must be more. And I used to see her at that activity every January. In the recent years, I'm sure she's not quite well enough to come. So I know that she did that. I think she continued in her practice until, you know, very few years ago. I think she was in her 80s, and she was still had her medical practice. And the other thing I know is that she was a very good friend of a cousin of my father's from Rochester, New York. And they were nurses together. However, this cousin of my father's, who would be my second cousin, never had gone on to medical school. But when she came to town when I was a child, I know she and Florence always got together, and they would come to our house. And that's really all I remember of her.
Okay, David, you mentioned a Dr. Wexler, and I asked you to find out what her first name was.
I checked through with my sister, and she believes that it was B.B. Wexler Baby Hospital. She thinks that is the name as far as she could remember, and the location I gave you was correct. It was Neville Street, across from, can't think of the green apartment building, the Neville House. Yeah, across the street from there, next door to Samson's funeral home, is where the building still exists.
Okay.
But that's where it was. And she said, to her knowledge, it was called the Wexler Baby Hospital, and she thinks his initials were B.B. Wexler.
Okay. We talked about tuition, or you mentioned tuition, and that you got half of the tuition. Was that $360?
The total was $360.
Okay.
My scholarship is $180.
All right. Do you remember when the Playhouse became part of Point Park?
I remember it. I was not part of the organization then, but I do remember when it happened. And a friend of mine, who I was a little bit instrumental in getting hired on the Playhouse staff in the early 50s, eventually became head of the Playhouse and the Performing Arts Department of Point Park. And it happened, I think, in the late 60s. That's about the time it happened, but I was out of there by that time.
Okay, I wanted to also ask you about Blandy's restaurant. Do you remember Frank Blandy? Do you remember the restaurant? And
Frank Blandy, when I first came back to Pittsburgh, had the concession for the Playhouse restaurant, although he was in it, to some extent, was an employee of the company. But he ran the Playhouse restaurant, which was in the lower part, the basement part of the old Playhouse building, and he ran a tremendously good restaurant, and business was unbelievably good. And then at some point, probably in the 52, 53, around in there, he took off and went down the street across from what is now the William Pitt Union, but it was then the Shenley Hotel, and he, in a building I think was owned by Nash Kelvinator, he took it over and opened the first Park Shenley restaurant, which he ran for many, many years. And then Frank went up to the Royal York and ran that for many years. And as a matter of fact, I believe today, after selling it, I understand he's back there as a consultant.
At the Coffre Vore.
Yeah, Coffre Vore. And I know Frank very well. And amazing thing about Frank, I don't think anybody would suspect how old he is, but he must be 82 or 83 by now. Yeah, I know him well. And before the Playhouse, he had a couple of successful restaurants in the sort of Fox Chapel area on Route 28. I can't think of the name of one of them, but it was a very successful restaurant.
Was there a name Fox involved with it or not?
I can't remember. But isn't that funny? But there was a restaurant right on old Freeport Road, and that was his first place. He probably, of all the restaurant people I've ever known, perhaps is the most instinctively right one. I can tell you some other interesting things about Frank Land if you want to hear it.
I tell you what, let's hold on to that for a little while, okay?
Yeah.
Thank you. You mentioned some TV stations, and I don't, on the tape, and I'm not sure, because you were an MC for 40 years, and you talked about going into, I know that you were with Channel 4.
For almost 30.
Okay.
And I still am associated with them. Maybe I talked about a television station called WDTV, which was the Dumont station. It was the first station on the air in the Pittsburgh market, and it went on the air in January 1949. I don't even think at that time it had any live cameras, but it did go on the air, and it was owned by Alan Dumont, who was one of the men responsible for inventing the tube that is used to project in your set, the television thing, the Orthicon tube, or I think it's called, and it's used in the camera. And he was really an inventor, but he got into the business because nobody else was in it. And he owned a station in New York and one here, I think in Washington, D.C. He had a little network, the Dumont Network, and their earliest success show was the first Jackie Gleason show. It was owned by Dumont. Cavalcade of Stars, and then Dumont was probably a better inventor and technician than he was a businessman.
What years are we talking about?
I'm talking 49 on till about 54 in Pittsburgh. Westinghouse Electric and Westinghouse Broadcasting wanted to have a television station. They had the famous KDK radio station, which was the pioneer radio station in the world. It had gone on the air in 1920. With the famous Harding Cox election returns. That was the first broadcast.
What day?
20.
November 1920. Yeah. Okay. And that's when the first, and they did that. The first real commercial broadcast came from that. And the interesting thing was that Cox was the man that ended up with the Atlanta newspapers and Cox Broadcasting, and they owned WPXI Channel 11 in Pittsburgh. And
for how long?
They've owned that since 1957. And, well, I think outright, maybe a few years later, because it was local ownership for a couple of years. The other thing interesting, this is stupid trivia, but you know that Cox's running mate in 1920 that was defeated was Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was vice presidential thing. He was Secretary of the Navy then. But KDKA was the pioneer station, because radio had really gotten its start here in Pittsburgh, an old East Pittsburgh plant at Westinghouse. And I think the original announcer, and I hope I have his name right, I think it's Rubenstein, he just died this year. He was like 96 years old, and he was an engineer, but mostly engineers were working in radio in those days because people didn't have any faith in it. So KDKA was anxious to maintain their position as a broadcaster in the Pittsburgh market, and they couldn't get a license because when the Korean War broke out, the government froze all the television licenses and you couldn't get a station permit to build. So Westinghouse went and bought the Dumont station, which was WDTV, operating on Channel 3. And they renamed it KDKA Television.
To this was what, in 51?
54.
54, okay.
And then it became Channel 2 eventually. And they had the market unto themselves for many years. The only competition in this market was the station in Johnstown that had gone on the air in about 46 or 47. It was an old station. And they sat that way, and then for the two remaining major outlets here, and they call VHF television, those are the stations from Channel 13 on down, which were better for broadcasting and for reception. Everyone fought for the two remaining ones. So what later became the Coxone Channel 11, WPXI, became a little merger with William Block Enterprises that owned the Post-Gazette, and WWSW, they owned at that time, a radio station, and the Brennan family from WJAS, instead of fighting, they got together and put that station on the air in 1957. And a couple of years later, Cox came along and bought them all out, and then they've owned the station since. The following year, after much bantering among people who wanted the license for Channel 4, a couple dropped out and two merged. One was the Hearst Corporation, H-E-A-R-S-T, and they had been owners of WCAE radio since 1922, which was an old-time station, too. They wanted it, as did Ed Hirschberg, who was in radio in East McKeesport. Someone else did in Irwin. Finally, what happened was the KQV owners at the time were I.D. Wolf, who was head of Kaufman's department store, and Earl Reed from Reed, Thorpe, and Armstrong Lawyers. They wanted it because KQV was in the broadcasting business. They owned that. So they made a deal. They went in together, Hearst and this conglomerate from KQV. And by law, one of them had to give up their radio station. They couldn't own two radio stations and the television station. So KQV was sold to the ABC network at that time. And for 3 years, it was a jointure. And in 1961, the Hearst Corporation bought out the I.D. Wolf, Earl Reed Group. And Hearst has owned it since, like, it's 30 years now that they've owned it. The profits that the local group made in 3 years were staggering. It was something like, I think that between $10 and $11 for every dollar invested. It was staggering. So, but that's how the three television stations came to be in this town. And KDK took the CBS affiliation because it was the best at the time. The second in was was WIIC originally, which is now WPXI, and they took NBC, and WTAE was suffered to get ABC, but that wasn't so bad. It was interesting that WIIC was the call letters of Channel 11 for many years, and the I's stood for 11 and the 1s and so forth, and then they had a change of administration once, and the new manager very cleverly named the WPXI, which I don't think anybody's ever understood. He named it after WPVI in Philadelphia, and PVI there stands for 6, VI for 6, and XI here stands for 11, but I swear nobody knows it. But that's
the Roman numerals.
Roman numerals.
Sure.
Yeah. So that was the story of the television market in Pittsburgh.
David, do you remember the first public television broadcast? I mean, I'm sure you weren't around at that point because I know it was very early, but do you have any recollection of the first?
You mean the actual ever that ever occurred?
Yes.
Well, they say that there were experiments as far back as 1913. One of the first scheduled shows that I know historically that I've read was the Al Smith Herbert Hoover, I don't know if it was the election returns, it could have been the convention, the Al Smith convention, I think was on television in 1927. The other big thrust with television was the 1939 World's Fair, where for the first time RCA showed it, and it was amazing how people would line up for hours to
and
see.
And where was the World's Fair?
At Flushing, New York, where the Trilon and Paris Fair, they're still there next to Shea Stadium, where, like, near LaGuardia. That was big. The first licensed station in the country was General Electric had a station in Schenectady, New York in 1943. That was the first official license one. I worked for an RCA mobile unit here in Pittsburgh in 1946 when I first got out of the service and I had gone back to school with Carnegie Tech in those days. And we did show every hour on the hour from the 11th floor of Kaufman's department store.
Which was at Smithfield?
Which was, you know, Smithfield and 5th and Forbes. But we did this for the summer, and several people that were from Carnegie Mellon, from Carnegie Tech in those days, worked with us, and the professional people from RCA. And it, oh, people were just thrilled. We would do the silliest shows, you know. I mean, somebody would stand up and say, Kaufman's was originally Kaufman and Bear, and their location was where Gimbel's was. And they do these, and people were just thrilled. They'd go all through the store and look at these sets, and we had audiences. And I did props and ran a camera a little bit in those days. And but we had people with us, like Bob Parks, who has been teaching voice and speech at Carnegie Mellon, and Al Checo, an actor friend of mine who happens to be in Pittsburgh this weekend. George Stepakis was my prop man with me, and he became the author George Christie, and he writes for Daily Variety out in the West Coast. But we were all kids, and we had a great time. I think we used to laugh. I think we all made $18.75 a week for working that television thing. But it was one of the first television, that, I think that was the actual first time Pittsburgh ever had a chance to see television.
And what was the idea? I mean, what was the main thrust?
The idea was RCA was going around trying to show what television can be and what it could do and eventually sell sets. And they would provide major department stores and outlets with a program like this for X number of weeks, and then to whet the appetite of the people. The sad part of it was they came back here a year or so later to a furniture store called Spears, which is 300 Wood Street now, and they did it again. And in those days, anytime anybody had a television set, it was usually at a bar or somebody who had a tremendous amount of money, because people just did not buy television sets. And when I was working in New York in 48 to 49, I used to go to my friend's office at J. Walter Thompson Advertising because they had a television set. We'd go there Tuesday nights to see Milton Berle. And if anything ever sold television sets in the early days, it was Milton Berle.
Was that the Texaco show?
The Texaco Star Theater. Because what happened was, if you were in New York at that time, it was almost eerie. Tuesday nights, the streets were empty, the theaters were empty, the restaurants were empty, and people would either gather in bars that had a television set, or they'd go to somebody's home that had one, to watch Milton Berle. And they really thought this was the demise of the whole entertainment and restaurant business. But it was a, you know, a period, that an adjustment period. People used to plant their noses against the appliance store windows in New York just to look at the set being on. And if anybody ever sold sets, it was Milton Berle. The old gag used to be, I got on television and I sold a lot of sets. My uncle sold his, my mother sold hers. But he sold television sets.
Uncle Milton.
Yeah.
David, I'd like you to talk a little bit about, or not a little bit, whatever amount it takes, about your time with Channel 4, and then I would like to have you give me something about Franklin P. Snyder.
Okay. Well, following my stay at the Playhouse in the 50s, I went and worked at an advertising agency in downtown Pittsburgh called the Vic Maitland Agency.
Vic?
V-I-C-M-A-I-T-L-A-N-D, Vic Maitland. Okay. And I sort of knew him from Peabody High School, although he was older than I. I know him, and he came along. He was opening an agency, and he hired me. And I worked there for little less than 3 years, but almost 3 years. And I did everything. I did publicity, I did copywriting, I was an account executive, I did all kinds of strange things, and never really liked it. I worked on the Duquesne beer account, that was one of our big accounts, and I always found it very frustrating. I don't know, something about agency work I never liked. So I decided to leave, and I went on my own for 2 years, and I had my own public relations firm, and it was during that period that Channel 4 went on the air. And I knew a lot of people there. And finally, I had a phone call from a friend of mine who had worked with me at the Maitland agency, Dave Murray, who actually was the first 11 o'clock newscaster in this town. He came here as a kid from Cincinnati, and I think he started in television when he was 16. And David was great on the air, but he always disliked being on the air. Anyway, he was program director at Channel 4. He had worked with me at Maitland. We shared an office. He called me and said, we had a promotion manager. He's leaving. No, I guess they had offered me a job as publicity director under this man, and I didn't want to do it. And so I stayed on my own business for a while. And then there was a performer at Channel 4 who had come from Channel 2 named Hank Stoll, who was a puppeteer. And a very mad man. He really, I still keep in touch with him. He's unbelievably wacky. But he was going to start a morning show at Channel 4. And he was looking for somebody to help him on the show. And Dave Murray had suggested that I work with him. Well, I had really performed for a lot of years and had no great desire. So, but I went out and we cut a pilot together with Joe Negri, the musician, and Ricky Wirtz, who was still around town, and Nick Perry, who got into trouble in this town. And we did a morning show called The Hank Stoll Show. And it was decided that this was it. And they called me in and made me an offer. I would help write it, and I would also perform on it. And it was probably Saturday Night Live in the morning, or something like that. It was a strange show. It was the kind of show that was typical of that period. Johnny Carson had a thing in the West Coast called Carson's Cellar. Almost every town had some kind of offbeat show. But ours was pretty well conceived, because Stoll was a good television technician. And we did the show, and I agreed on the condition that I would be out of the building by 9:30, because I had to go and keep running my public relations business that I went into after I left this advertising agency. And then Franklin Snyder, who was the vice president general manager, before the show went on the air, called me in and said, "We're losing our promotion manager. Why don't you do both things for us?"
And what I year said, was that?
1960. And I said, "Gee, Frank, I don't know. That's an awful lot of work." So he made me a real decent offer. And then I said, "Well, I'll do it on one condition. If the television show, which hadn't even gone on yet, if it bombs and flops, I don't want my salary cut in half." So he agreed it would only be cut a certain percentage. So I closed up my public relations business, and the world did not suffer from the fact that I closed it up. And I went to work. We did the morning show 5 mornings a week. And that was me getting up about 5 o'clock, getting the studio at 7, going on the air at 8. And then we'd go upstairs and write the next day's show.
What was the name of the show?
The Hank Stoll Show.
That was, okay.
Yeah, and Joe Negri and I were the co-hosters with him. And we did this show for a year.
It was live.
Live. Boy, was it live. And then we'd go upstairs and write the next day's show on little 3x5 cards. That's so we all carried them with us because we didn't have time to write scripts. And then I'd go down and do my promotion manager's job, which meant all the advertising, public relations, special events, community activities for the station. And I had a staff of about 4 or 5 people working for me. Well, I'll tell you, by the following July, I was a basket case. It was a lot of work. I was just tired. And Hank lost interest in the show, really, which is typical of him in a way. He'll start something and work hard at it, and then he vacillates a little bit. So he didn't care if it went on, and I didn't care if it went on, and Negri had other places to go, so we folded the show. And then Frank Snyder said to me, well, you stay with us, but I'm not going to cut your salary. So he gave me the whole thing. And that became my career. So I stayed at Channel 4 as promotion manager. And I did this for 20 years. Then the last 9 years, I did collateral work in that area. I became director of public relations and special projects for the station. And I did some work for the Hearst Corporation. But during the time, I had a interesting career in the sense that it was fun, sometimes frustrating. The 60s were a breeze. The network was doing better. I got my trips to Hollywood every year. Used to handle all the stars that came to town. That was my duty to pick them up and babysit them. And in those days, before satellite, they did travel. Today, they sit and do it on satellite interviews. No, they don't get on airplanes anymore. But I used to do the limousines and the hotel suites, and I had some funny experiences, some dumb ones. But I did that for many years. And then I also started representing the station in the community and got on many boards and did a lot of speaking on their behalf. I also got involved with the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters, which was an association of radio and television stations within the state. Frank Snyder had been president. I've kept following him. He was president of the Radio Television Club locally, then I became president of the Radio Television Club locally. Then he was president of the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters, and a few years later, I was. And I did so many things for them. I did about 17 dinners in Washington, D.C. over 17 years, I guess. We used to, in front of the congressional delegation and government officials like FCC people and cabinet people, would honor some native Pennsylvanian, and I emceed all those dinners. And then we started moving them to Hershey, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and I just did one for Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, about 3 weeks ago here in Pittsburgh. And I was thinking there had been, I think, 24 of these dinners. The first was to honor Ed Wynn, and I didn't go to that one. It was 1966, I think. But in 67, they honored Gene Kelly.
Ed Wynn was Keenan Wynn's father, is that
That's
correct?
That's right.
Ed Wynn, what year was that?
66, Ed Wynn, and he was the Texaco fire chief.
Right.
And then...
that was on the Milton Berle.
Well, it was before, he did it on radio.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the second one honored him?
And they said Gene Kelly.
That's
and I remember going
he's
down.
He's a Pittsburgher.
Yeah, he's a Pittsburgher. And I remember flying down for that one with Harold Cohn, who was the drama critic of the Post Gazette, who was a good friend of Gene Kelly's. Then the following year, I think it was Scranton, and I wrote some material because Frank Snyder had to introduce him.
That was Governor Scranton.
Governor Scranton at the time. And then. Anyhow, the following year, unbeknownst to me, Franklin Snyder had volunteered me to MC the one for Joe Paterno, and I really didn't know about it, but I also didn't feel good at the time. It was the year my mother died, it was 1970, and I was just burned out, and I started to do another live television show, and it was all, I think, too much. Anyhow, I MC'd that one in 1970, and I have MC'd every one of them for all those years.
And the names?
All the names, they've gone from Shirley Jones to Gene Stapleton to Jack Palance to James Michener to Leonard Goldenson, who was head of the ABC network, and he's from Scottsdale, PA, as a matter of fact. Roy Campanella, the baseball player, who's from Homestead. Jimmy Stewart. I did Arnold Palmer. I've done Senator Scott. Well, the list goes on and on. It really does. And there's some interesting Art Rooney, the old man. He was great.
Oh, the Pittsburgh Pirates, right?
Yeah, great story on Art Rooney with Judge Sirica of Watergate fame. That happened that night. Yeah. But anyway, I did all of those things. In the meantime, I did two other live shows on television. In 63, following a Christmas party, and I've done every Christmas party for the Channel 4 since 1960, and I still do them. I go back every Christmas and do their Christmas party, do a little show with Joe Negri. After one of the shows, Snyder said, why don't you go back on the air? So Stoll and I and a few people, including my wife, Lucy, and Nellie King, an ex-baseball player for the Pirates, we all went on the air. We did a show called Saturday Night Instead of the Movies. The title was better than the show. And we had a live studio audience every Saturday night. It was like, this was like Saturday Night Live. It really was. We did this in 63, and we stayed on the air until Jerry Lewis came on the ABC network and kicked us off the air. But it was a drag. We used to do an hour and 15 minutes live with no staff to write. And how we lived through it, I don't know. My wife said that ended her television career. She never went back on. She hated it. But we did that. And then in 70, I told you earlier that I was really worn out. I had come back from a vacation with a beard, and John Conomikes, who was going to take this actual operation of the station over from Frank Snyder as he moved up in the Hearst broadcasting world, said to me, don't shave it, we have some old Charlie Chan movies, and so why don't you host them? So I hosted Charlie Chan movies every Saturday night for a year here, and then for another almost a year in Washington, D.C. I used to go down there once a month and tape them, and I played a character who was a criminologist friend of Charlie Chan, and Chan had left all this memorabilia to him, so I did that scam for a couple of years. I don't think I did much to move the future of television, but it did pay for a couple of years in college, I'll tell you, for our oldest child.
David, you mentioned boards. What other boards were you on? You can just write this chronologically.
But say them slow.
Okay, let's see, I was on the Radio Television Club Board of Directors. I was on the Civic Life.